Today's episode of Sacktown Talks by the Nooner is a weekly political news roundup with Scott Lay, and of course, I'm Gibran Maciel. Scott and I discussed the top headlines in the week for about an hour. We threw out the script and decided to just have a conversation. Remember, Scott and I are not journalists. Interested in becoming a guest or sponsor of the show? Send us a message. Our emails are included in the show notes below. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Here we go in 3, 2, 1.
Yes, it's another episode of Sacktown Talks by the Nooner with my man Scott Lay. I, of course, am Gibran Maciel. Where to find us? You can find us on iTunes, wherever else you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube if you want the closed captioning, and Facebook as well. Don't ask what your podcast can do for you. Ask what you can do for your podcast. Share us with a friend. Put out the good word. This is a premier podcast in California politics and policy. I'm so excited what we're doing with Scott Lay. Again, he's bringing a level of analysis that is just not offered anywhere else. We've received great feedback on the first episode, and we've got a couple of great guests booked in the upcoming weeks.
Don't jinx it.
Okay, I'm not going to jinx.
They're inked.
So I'm not going
to
say anything.
I told Alexa to put them on my calendar and all.
Okay, so we won't jinx it until they're in here. Send us an email if you'd like to sponsor the show or come on the show. Man, what a week.
What a week. Politics. Well, before we get there, isn't it true that I actually made a little page on aroundthecapitol.com? That's Around the Capitol with an O, where we've got all those links to YouTube, Facebook, and iTunes to the podcast.
Around the Capitol, where you can find the Nooner?
That's where you find the Nooner also. Yeah. What a week. We just were sitting around this table with Assemblymember Brian Manshine, and like it was like going to be all cool. It's like February. It's before the bill deadline. I was over at the Capitol today.
It should be pretty sleepy over there, yeah.
Lobbyists are running around crazy because they got to get their bills introduced. So it's an exciting time, and it's been an exciting week. So let's spend some time chatting about it.
Yeah, just for folks listening, you know, we're gonna do the guests. That'll probably be the mainstay of the podcast format. But I think every once in a while, maybe every week or so, Scott and I are just gonna get together and do like a weekly news roundup, hopefully in a conversational and sort of fun sort of way. So if you didn't get your weekly news roundup, or if you want to hear it from another angle, tune in with us. Let's start kind of still California, but on a national stage. Kamala Harris.
What a wonderful introduction to the America she had. She had this amazing rollout, 20,000 people in Oakland. And what happened this week?
Well, she hit a bump over the Smollett thing.
Smollett, who's that guy? That guy from Empire?
The Empire guy, yeah. Oh. She hit a bump. Well, you know what? Okay, so let's go over the tweet here. Okay, here's the tweet again. So for folks listening, here's the, you know, let's just go over a legal term for you, the fact pattern, right? What actually happened? The actor, Smollett, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. No disrespect if I'm not. He said, you know, he was approached and, you know, he was approached and assaulted. A noose was hung around his neck. And I think they threw bleach on his face. Is what they said. What he said?
An unknown substance
on his head.
Now has been tested to be aspirin.
Okay, right. And his assailant said, "Oh, this is MAGA country," you know. And there was this whole narrative wrapped around it that it was like a modern day lynching, right?
And this was happening at 2 a.m. and it was below zero out in Chicago, as Don Lemon reported on CNN tonight.
Okay.
So we're recording this on Wednesday night. It'll be up next couple days. He was just charged with unruly conduct, whatever the legal term that I should remember, disruptive conduct for filing a false police report.
So
it had been rumored that there were concerns about him and the story. The grand jury did not file an indictment, but he has been charged by the district attorney. And was, as of this recording, was going to make arrangements to appear at the police station.
As severe as the legal consequences could be, even worse is the shade that's being thrown his way on Instagram and Twitter and stuff. I mean, he's getting all this smoke thrown his way. And I think what's unfortunate about it is that, yeah, I mean, he did something wrong. You know, I mean, let's step back. Kamala Harris responded with this tweet. Jussie Smollett is one of the kindest, most gentle human beings I know. I'm praying for his quick recovery. This was an attempted modern-day lynching. This is Kamala's tweet. No one should have to fear for their life because of their sexuality or color of their skin. We must confront this hate.
Now, and Donald Trump, President Trump, did also provide a tweet that was in sympathy for Smollett. So Kamala wasn't alone, but she went further by calling it the modern day lynching.
Yeah, and saying that we have to confront the hate. You know, and I think this is one of the things that, we, when we mapped out what we wanted to talk about this week, is sort of like, you know, in every particular instance, there's a broader principle underlying what's going on, right? And I think that there's a couple things going on here. One is that, man, Jussie Smollett's probably pretty hard pressed to stay in the headlines, pretty hard pressed to have some sort of like earned media presence. I hate to say that, but there's like this like continual churn of like our media relevance, you know. There's also this like almost fetishization of victimhood on the far left, where you get extra attention, you are revered for overcoming. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, except that when it perverts the way that people present themselves in this, like in this particular case. And another thing that's going on is that the media and the Twitterverse and the various echo chambers on the right and the left and the middle are quick to create narratives around things that have not yet been confirmed to be true, right? So, you know, when all these things happen, this pressure cooker eventually spits out Jussie Smollett, right?
Well, and from what I've heard from his professional colleagues and some of his friends and family, they said he was doing well. There, it wasn't like he was on the downfall. He was still on the ascendancy to stardom with no known problems. But if the allegations are true, we're probably talking about a significant mental health issue.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And so how does Kamala step in it? She steps in it by taking it into...
She steps in it.
Yeah, she steps in it. She steps in it when it's not true. She steps it by taking... You know, what's interesting is that the tweet isn't on its face untrue. Like, no one should have to fear for their life. No one, because of their sexuality or the color of their skin. The lynching thing, is, you know, especially when it proved not to be true, right? And I think that, you know, it's the same thing with the Covington High School kids, right? It's like we're so quick to jump onto this bandwagon of like we want to react to these narratives as a way of planting our own flag in the ground. It's like, hey, we need to make sure that these narratives are okay, you know, that these narratives actually happened this way, you know. She is, you know, I know she's your darling candidate. I'm not there with her yet.
I don't endorse
come
anybody.
On you like her, it's okay, you like her,
you know. I'm a fanboy for anybody from California.
That's fair. She was also criticized for not campaigning more in New Hampshire.
Yeah, before we get there, I do want to hesitate and say, you know, Kamala is not somebody that I think is always doing her own tweeting. I mean, we kind of know when the President of the United States is tweeting at like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Who else could come up with such prose?
I mean, when the staff come up with this, well, we intentionally do spelling errors, you know, and weird capitalization. And, you know, so we don't know if Kamala actually did the tweet or even knew about it.
Wait, let's talk about that though. All elected officials do your own tweeting.
That they should.
All elected officials, you know, if any of you are listening, do your own tweeting. You know why? Because if you step in it, do you have an idea how lame you sound when you say, oh, that was my staffer? Do you have an idea how like unaccountable, irresponsible, lame, and impotent almost you sound? Like, that was my staff. Just do it yourself.
Just have
don't be afraid.
And have a campaign account that is like, you know, just known to be from the campaign, and you do one that's personal. Like Barack Obama did the -BO. At the end of the tweets that he did personally. So he made it clear which ones were his and which ones were staff. Yeah. You know, we shouldn't have to parse out, okay, who was responsible for a tweet that's on an official account of a state legislator or a candidate for president.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that was one of those things that always, I don't know, like when I was doing communications in the building, I was always a fan. It's like, you know, like when I was working for Jimmy or Tony or whoever, and I was always like, JimmyGomez.com should still be its own thing. You should have your own campaign people working on that. TonyAtkins.com should still be its own. Like, don't like fire it up every time you run for office again. Put on your accomplishments. I keep it going. Right, build your own name brand on top of just being a legislator. You're still a fixture in your community. You're still, you know, a beacon for progressive values and, you know, in the LGBT community or whatever. But yeah, I think a lot of folks will maybe turn over their sort of digital and social media personas over to the staffers and kind of like cloister up, you know?
Well, on
probably
that,
because they get scrutinized like
right.
this.
Well, and on that note, and I know there are a lot of young staffers that are ambitious, that are our yeah. listeners, my readers, that are thinking about Future Office. Get that domain now. I'm looking at domains already for 2020 where somebody's like running for office and it's like their name 2020.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, I'm going to run that one time and lose. You want to have a domain that's going to last for several cycles. Get it now. I got scottlay.com like 25 years ago before there was a web. I think I just had like, you know, a telnet access to scottlay.com.
Yeah, I'm sitting on gebronmaciel.com.
There you go.
I am never running for office, but
I did. I tried it once.
Did you really?
No. Yeah, Davis City Council, 1996.
What happened?
It happened to be 1996 is when we had an early primary. I think it was March 26, 1996, as we as Californians try to influence the presidential election.
Okay.
Happened to be spring break in Davis.
Everyone's gone?
Everyone's gone. And this is really before, you know, before this whole vote by mail, you know, vote for 60 days thing that we've got going on now.
Yeah.
Vote for 30 days, count for 60.
Yeah.
So I came in the middle of the pack. It was a good experience, and I lost, and I went to law school. So it all worked out okay for me.
Very cool.
Hey. So New Hampshire. So what's going on there? Why is there so much criticism of Kamala not spending the last 2 years in New Hampshire when their primary is actually a year and a week, or is actually a year from now, a week later, then ballots start arriving in mailboxes in California.
I actually can't understand it. I would focus on California, so I don't actually understand why she would be, you know, I guess there's some sort of like horse race aspect to this where the pundits who are covering it want to really make a big deal about who won New Hampshire.
Yes, but John King on CNN has his magic wall.
Yeah.
Well, his magic wall will show 25 roughly delegates from Iowa. While California is
475.
That was 2016. It'll be adjusted up. It'll probably be closer to 500 for California in 2020. And we won't know those results until about a month after the March 4th, 2020 primary in California.
Yeah.
So near April 4th. So we have 22 other states are going to cast ballots between the time Californians get their ballots in their mailbox, probably a majority of California Democratic primary voters, from the time they get it to the time the ballots are fully tabulated in California, 22 other states will have voted. And then all of a sudden, there's this tidal wave from California of delegates.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, for the Democratic primary, that's where you really want to make a stand, right? It's in California.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, it's complicated. And, you know, I have to plug a great article that Paul Mitchell wrote for Capital Weekly last week, Paul Mitchell with Political Data, where he looks at kind of the challenge of California, because it's not a winner-take-all state. Delegates in the Democratic primary are allocated on a congressional district basis. Any candidate has to get at least 15% in that congressional district to win any delegates. And it's also, unlike the Republican Party, Democratic primary is an open primary. Anybody can pick a Democratic ballot.
That's right.
So there are a lot of things going on. We got to get Paul Mitchell on this little cast here.
Yeah, Paul, you got to come on the show, brother. Paul's in, he's in D.C. this week.
He's at the Georgetown basketball game. He was
tweeting
earlier tonight.
That's what he went for? Good for him.
That's not what he went for, but somehow he got like tickets in the front row.
So, you know, she was criticized for not campaigning more in New Hampshire. I really think a lot of that is just, you know, people want to do that horse race aspect, you know, the magic wall that you talked about. But let me put on my, you know, you're more educated than I am. Like, you got the advanced degree. I'm kind of more of like a little bit of a caveman here. And like my visceral reaction to this is that those people don't know anything. The magic wall people, the pundits, all these. I mean, just look back at the 2016 election. You know, no one could have told you that Trump was going to win this thing, right? Those folks, you know, the pundit class, the professional media, you know, predictive, you know, horse race class, don't know what they're talking about. They're really pretty to look at. They look good on camera. And, you know, they kind of got their thing that they're set into in the way that they cover things. But that's not really predictive of the outcome in my in my personal view. You know, maybe I'm just railing against the machine.
Well,
here,
no, and I think that's largely the case. But I think, you know, a John King on CNN, I think a Chuck Todd on NBC, you know, those are pretty darn smart political reporters, and nobody would deny that. The problem is they're expected to fill content. You know, it's like, oh, well, you're on the payroll, so you've got to talk. So now Chuck Todd, when he used to talk on Sunday mornings for an hour, is now on, it's a 5 day a week
weekday
show. Yeah. And so it's all this extra content that they have to come up with. And so, you know, it's like, okay, well, which of the possible 20 Democratic presidential candidates will we have on today, even if they've got an infinitesimal chance of actually winning?
Gotcha.
Well, you know, Gibran, is it true that we've got a sponsor this week?
Hey, I heard it's true, brother.
Wow.
Here we go. Another big week. Another big item in this week. Probolsky Research, California's premier independent opinion research firm for polling, focus groups, and engagement on elections and public policy.
Well, you know, people that read me know that, like, I'm totally skeptical on polls.
Yeah.
I like to call BS when I can. And... you know, a thing I like about Probolsky, and they've been, you know, candidly an advertiser in the Nooner for a couple of years. Whenever I see a poll by Probolsky, I can follow up with Adam and say, hey, what's a story? What's a methodology on this poll? I know that it's nonpartisan, that he works with a lot of different clients, cities, counties, special districts, businesses, and in assessing public opinion. And I know that I can get the truth about methodology that I usually don't get about tweets, about polls that I see on Twitter. So I'm glad that Probolsky's on board. I hope he comes back, and folks can check him out at Probolsky, P-R-O-B-O-L-S-K-Y, research.com.
ProbolskyResearch.com, California's top public agency pollsters, cities, counties, special districts, water districts, annexation rate structures. They all call him Probolsky.
Did I spell ProbolskyResearch.com right?
I think you did.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, good. We're off to a good start here.
Hey, so another thing that happened this week, and we've been talking about this personally, you and I, for a little while, is the Californian Trump divide continues to sort of like, it's a chasm, right? Now it's like this huge cleavage.
There is a wall. Oh, no.
No. Yeah.
Bad analogy.
That's insensitive, Scott. But, you know, so two big things, right? The high-speed rail thing, and maybe we can stop there and deconstruct that a little bit. And then the immigration stuff. What happened in immigration? Can we start with the wall thing real quick? Just because I want to pick your legal brain on this thing.
Right?
The emergency declaration, okay? Right. From a skeptic's point of view, okay? Pull me off this ledge, okay?
Okay, so the concept of a president declaring a national emergency is nothing new.
Yeah.
But it was the mid-1970s where it was put into law by Congress. And a flaw in the law is it doesn't define what a national emergency is.
Now, let me stop you there. Is that a flaw or, you know, specific? You know what? When I was working in the building, these lobbyists would come in with their slicked back hair and their pocket squares.
That's why I'm not still lobbying.
And they would just say, you know, a thing they overlooked. And I'm like thinking to myself, wow, is that really something they overlooked? Or is that something they potentially explicitly omitted, right? Mm-hmm. And my question is, like, it's hard to define an emergency. Now, just let me be perfectly clear. I don't believe we have an emergency on our southern border. However, my question is, I don't think they just omitted it. You know, I think there's probably a pretty hard thing to define. And this is me putting my skeptic hat on, right? Like, talk me back from this, okay? My understanding is he declares a national emergency. It will be litigated. There's now a 16 state lawsuit. California's leading the charge.
15 other states.
15 other
they're
states.
Leading the charge, but California is actually the, you know, putting the most resources.
Yeah, California's putting the most resources.
Lead plaintiff.
Right. So the president declares a national emergency. 16 states say, no, it's not an emergency. Don't have this power. It gets litigated, right? The end result has to be, by definition, constitutional.
Right.
So what's a...
I hate that a national emergency was declared.
No, I agree.
I hate the consequences of it. I do think that at the end of the day, a court does what it often does in these situations and says it's a political question. The Supreme Court doesn't like to get in between Congress and the executive. Whenever possible, they don't. And that's what California is asking for right now. Congress appropriated money, and the president is using a vague statute to reappropriate that money as under, under a national emergency. That is a political question. If Congress wanted to specify clearly what a national emergency is, then they should have written it. So I think it's a tough row to hoe for California.
Yeah, I think plaintiffs. I feel like I have to say this. Someone said to me one time, you know, Jabron, your problem is you're not optically diverse. I think they were talking about my light skin tone.
Yes. Okay.
So folks, Mexican immigrant brought over here in my mother's arm, was naturalized right before my 18th birthday. I am no ally of Trump's, okay? I'm not. However, I have to think that he's got somewhat of a case here. Or even if he doesn't have somewhat of a case here, he reached for power that perhaps wasn't his. But if it genuinely wasn't his, then the court will claw him back. And the end result's constitutional. So when all these people are saying, oh, it's unconstitutional, it's a power grab. No, he's going for it. The courts will decide. And the end result's constitutional or not. What they're really saying is like, boo, I don't like it. In my opinion.
But like, this is like the first quarter in the NBA All-Star game. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House of Representatives now control the purse strings of the House. Who cares, frankly, about the national emergency? Yes, it's a big deal for California, but that's the short game. The long game is that if relationship isn't healed between the House and the president, then he's not going to get anything he wants through 2020 and possibly beyond.
Well, I mean, he's gonna have to figure out exactly what he can extract out of those executive orders for 2 years.
Right.
But he
can't get money.
Right.
The only money he can get is that which has already been appropriated. So the situation we have with California is California got $2 billion in stimulus money. Remember the Barack Obama American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
So we
got $2 billion, and that's what's being spent right now in the Central Valley, in which Governor Newsom plans to extend from Merced to Bakersfield. There's another $928 million grant that had been tentatively approved by the Federal Railroad Administration. That is what yesterday, so Tuesday as of this taping, that is what
He's
the Trump administration
back.
Is trying to pull back. They're trying to cancel that grant. That grant was envisioned to help complete the planning of the Los Angeles to San Francisco route, which that is what, you know, there's been a lot of confusion. And Governor Newsom's taken some hits about the confusion as to what exactly he is proposing for high-speed rail based on what he said in the state address.
Yeah.
What he's saying is we're going to finish the bricks and mortar and operations of Merced to Bakersfield, and we're going to finish the planning of Los Angeles to San Francisco. Meanwhile, do some of the regional
electrification and stuff.
Electrification
like that.
Of Caltrain, that sort of thing. And then we'll have to wait and see on the public-private partnership and obviously a federal investment.
The federal administration that cares, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people keep comparing California and America to other countries. Well, if this was a national priority, we could do it. We don't care about deficits and debt. We just hit an all-time, you know, a record high in debt. Democrats and Republicans are responsible for that. We easily could build high-speed rail in several states by simply borrowing money.
Well, so tell me that this is wrong, okay? The best thing President Obama could have done for high-speed rail could have been to nationalize the issue, declared it, you know, of national importance, and just like waive California's environmental review process.
But that's federal law. I mean,
they couldn't have done anything to preempt
CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. Yeah. Remember, we've got the Endangered Species Act and other Nixon.
They couldn't have done anything to preempt the California review process.
You know, Endangered Species Act is a big part of this. Now, CEQA kind of oftentimes, you know, it's a higher standard.
Okay.
But you know, and so it's kind of Endangered Species Act is kind of taken care of as part of the CEQA process. But you could take away CEQA and you still have Endangered Species Act, and so you might have a critter on that train route that becomes a problem. So I don't think there was any magic wand.
Okay.
There.
Hey, so
it is expensive.
So at face value, what are your thoughts on what the governor said about high speed rail? Just your thoughts.
I mean, I think
people want to hear from you, Scott.
Yeah. You can't pull the plug. We've already taken land from a lot of landowners through eminent domain. There's construction in a lot of parts in the Central Valley. I'm told by folks that have driven past it, it's kind of strange because you just have these strange segments. And yeah. it's like bridges that have,
to nowhere.
Parts have fallen off, the bridge to nowhere. But it makes no sense to just pull the plug on that completely, particularly if there is the money available to complete that segment. I think, and I haven't talked to anybody in the administration about this, but I think that a thought is you get Merced to Bakersfield up and running. You show that it is cost neutral, that it's not requiring a public subsidy for operating costs. Construction, yes, but mm-hmm. not operating costs. That was part of Proposition 1A, initiative to allow the state to borrow money for the project. You can't have an operational subsidy. Mm-hmm. I think after you get that working, then there might be a willingness to go back to the voters to ask for more money to connect to the more urban areas, which are the biggest supporters in the state of, or were the biggest supporters of Prop 1A.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do you think the chances are? Yeah. I mean, Gavin Newsom said this in his, Anthony Rendon said this on the Political Breakdown podcast. Mm-hmm. He had like a French consultant come talk to him about high speed rail. He said, make sure you connect it. Population centers, 4 million or more. Well, great. We're going to Bakersfield. I mean, Amtrak doesn't operate without a public subsidy, right? I mean, I think the chances of this thing operating without a public subsidy are exactly zero, right? And so I'm worried that they are going to build it from Merced to Bakersfield, and it's going to fulfill everyone's expectations mm-hmm. of not operating without a public subsidy, and then we're going to walk away from it. You know, I mean, this whole thing is, if you're gonna build it, man, just go up the road a little bit and connect us to San Francisco. You know, connect us to Sacramento and San Francisco, and get those urban corridors together. You know,
right. But that's where it's a lot more expensive.
Yeah, that's where it's a lot more expensive. But that's when you're actually gonna have something to show.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when this thing gets built from Merced to Bakersfield, it's gonna be the biggest. It's gonna be the biggest just fleecing. You know, people are just gonna point to it and say that's why we can't do it here. You know, I think that there's going to be a decade of that thing running empty, you know, empty station to empty station. And people are going to be like, man, it was a bad idea then. Let's not do it here. You know?
Well, I've heard from a lot of people that say,
weird. It's a half measure.
Yeah. And rail already isn't cheap.
Yeah.
People think that it's a lot cheaper than jumping on, the big Southwest jet. And it really is not. And high speed rail will not. Now, when I was traveling for community colleges all those years, would I have loved to have had a fast route to Bakersfield instead of driving, as I could listen to Gibran talk on Sacktown Talks? Absolutely. It's going to be expensive. And I think the question of whether it can operate without an operational subsidy is a big one.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, another area when we talk about the national emergency beyond high-speed rail and the possible loss of this $2 billion and $928 million, or the request to give back $2 billion, not going to happen, and the cancellation of the $928 million grant, is the threat of other funding that might be pulled back and diverted to the wall. Initially, the only thing really affecting California is the threat on the high-speed rail. It's unclear if the military construction funds really would hit California. That was the biggest pot of money that the president is repurposing under the Emergency Act. The high-speed rail thing is a whole separate issue. But there is a big concern about water and whether money that is dedicated to flood control through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers might be
like the levees here.
It's the levees here. Yeah. In particular, it's Folsom Lake. Enhancing the flood protection around Folsom Lake, as well as the Yuba River basin which is north, basically due north of where we're recording this podcast.
Like up by Marysville.
At Marysville. And yeah. The interesting thing is we're talking about Republican districts. And, you know, would President Trump go so far as to, you know, take away...
defund his own district.
These big yeah. projects. And, you know, there's only, you know, I always kind of hate to say it. There's seven congressional Republicans out of 53 members of Congress from California now. It's kind of hard to like target Republican districts, if you will, yeah. but that's where the federal money is.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's ag and water and... Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, there was a big story that broke this week based on a study that there's the Whittier Narrows Dam, I want to say it's called, down outside of Montebello in Southern California. And that dam is one that there are significant concerns about it breaching at some point and causing the evacuation of 2.5 million Southern Californians as the L.A. Basin basically fills up
with
water.
They just did a... arc storm, right? They just did a story on this. Was it
yeah.
the LA Times?
It was a study, an academic study that several news outlets picked up. I don't know, and I haven't had time to research if that's a state or a federal project, but you know, that's a kind of infrastructure issue that clearly California is looking for help from Washington. And I don't know that with the Trump California divide, if we're going to be seeing any heroic yeah. acts anytime soon.
you know, when I, when I see these like Trump versus California stuff, especially when he says like, "Hey, I'm going to claw this funding back," I think about like one that it's probably not a real substantive threat because a lot of like you know he came through. I think they came through with a lot of the fire relief money,
right?
And they came through, you know, and there was threats back then that like unless we got our forestry protection, you know,
unless
in mind,
we raked our forests,
yeah, you know, and it actually makes me think a lot about Victor Davis Hanson. You know, Victor, if you're listening, man, dude, come on the show. He was a professor of military history at Fresno State. He should probably honestly be inducted into the California Hall of Fame because this guy is a freaking genius. But he's one of the thought leaders.
After Guy Fieri gets in there for all the cooking he does for our disasters, you know.
But he's one of the thought leaders on the right. And he's a fellow at the Hoover Institution. And I won't spend too long on this, but. He's one of the few military historians that's really dedicated to that academic practice. So he spent like, I think, 3 to 5 years guest lecturing at West Point. And he said that, you know, this thing about wars is that, you know, people seem to think that wars are fought over resources and that people seem to think that wars are fought over misunderstandings and stuff like that. And he says that really wars are fought over cultural issues. And wars are, you know, at least in the classical sense, you know, in his right. classical sense, wars are fought over cultural issues. There's no misunderstanding. There's feelings of slight, of being slighted, of honor and jealousy and national pride involved, right? And we're not in a physical state of war, you know, between our two, you know, between the right and the left, but we, you know, we're in a state of, I think, narrative, you know, two competing narratives are at war in America between the right and the left. And the president is definitely, you know, firmly in control of the narrative on the right, you know? And I think when he says he's going to defund California for this, or he's going to defund California for that, I don't think he's looking at that. I don't think he's that sophisticated. You know, I think he doesn't have your mind, man. He's not looking at the districts. He's just saying like, I got all the, it's red meat for,
well, he knows
meat
the states though. Does he, I mean, I don't know if he cares about Doug LaMalfa.
He's
who
got
represents
50
Yuba.
Million people that want to hear I'm defunding California is what I think.
Well, and think about rail. I mean, yeah. Rail serves largely urban areas, Democratic areas, even light rail. If you look at where it is in red states, it's in metropolitan areas, Austin and Texas, yeah. liberal areas. And so it didn't cost him anything. He can beat the heck out of California high-speed rail. And for Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota, you know, that's, you know, that's some good red meat politics for
yeah, him. I think he just likes to, and I think he likes to trigger us.
Yeah.
And we keep falling for it. He's like the girl that holds the football for Charlie Brown, you know? Yeah. And we keep like kicking him like, oh, we're so upset. Like, I think at some point you should just, you know, they say on the internet, don't feed the trolls.
Right.
Like, I think a lot of the times, but it's so problematic because his Twitter is an actual communication from the office of the president, like from the president, right? So it's so problematic. But I wish he was that sophisticated, but I think he's just trolling us, man. I don't know.
He's looking for a response. I think that's clear. I mean, I get up this morning, got up at 5 a.m.
and you responded.
There were six tweets. There were none about California. Then another tweet came in. It wasn't about California. It was saying that the New York Times is fake news. I had to laugh. I think that was one I tweeted on because like one of the headlines was in the New York Times front page was like totally a pro-Trump issue. I forget what it was. But then at 6:13 a.m., he said, okay, enough Californians have woken up. So then he tweeted against us. This is what I do with my mornings. I know you're doing jiu-jitsu and cool stuff.
Yeah, man, I got jiu-jitsu at 6 a.m. Hey, for everyone listening, ESAC BJJ, your host, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy, where we believe in jiu-jitsu for everybody.
He keeps saying that to try and get me over there. I don't know about that.
I'll come check it out.
I'm still working on child's pose.
Let me tell you what we believe. We don't drop you off a cliff. You know, they say, Jordan Peterson says this. He says, you know, because he does a lot of work for PTSD with veterans. He says, you can't make the world a safer place. You can make braver people. And so, you know, what a lot of his protocol for helping vets deal with PTSD is actually help having them confront that nastiness and that ugliness that they went through.
Yeah.
And saying like, hey, you know, I live through it and I can rise to the occasion if need be again. You know, instead of making like a safe space for them, because you can never fully encapsulate somebody in a safe space, you kind of make them a little bit braver, you know? And in some way, that's kind of what we do with jiu-jitsu is like, hey, we start with this. Can we get you to do an arm bar against someone who's not fighting? Now we can get you to do this. Now we can get you to do that. And then over time, you kind of like hike down this big mountain as opposed to being thrown off a cliff, you know, because, you know, we can't have you sparring on your first day and stuff like that. It's more like, you know, we just have you kind of gradually expose you to your fears. And then over time, you accomplish more than you thought you would, at least.
I always wondered, I listen to a lot of podcasts and people are talking like, and they're like, they say they're taping late at night. And for those who are listening later, it's 10 o'clock Pacific Standard Time right now. I was up at 5 a.m. So all I'm thinking about right now is not some cool jiu-jitsu move. I'm thinking about child's pose do some yin yoga before I go to bed tonight. But some other things happened this week. Today, there was a press conference announcing a package on sugar-sweetened beverages.
Yeah.
And these bills have been around for quite some time. There was a deal last session.
Yeah, talk to us about that.
There was a deal to basically preempt new local taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages. So several cities were looking at,
little city taxes, right?
The headline was, we want to reduce, the health incidences related to sugar-sweetened beverages among our youth. And so they were implementing a tax to disincentivize the purchase of sugar-sweetened use and push them toward non-sugar-sweetened beverages. Of course, whenever we talk about user fees like that, the revenue is always part of the picture.
Yeah.
But the beverage industry, American Beverage Association, which is the big soda companies largely, they were preparing to do a ballot measure that would have preempted any new local fees, not just on sugar sweetened beverages, but
They dropped like $8 million on it, right?
Yeah, they spent big money to qualify. And the legislature said, okay, we will do a moratorium essentially and let those that have already approved the soda taxes keep them, but nobody else could add them on.
Yeah.
Well,
so just to be perfectly clear, the American beverage industry is flirting with, hey, we're gonna probably pass this thing because we put $8 million in the till for it. So, you know, won't you make a concession for us? Is that fair?
That's right.
Okay.
So now Democratic legislators
are pissed.
They're pissed. And I believe they had the support last session. I don't know about all of the bills, but they had the support last session on some of the bills of the California Medical Association and California Dental Association, obviously major Sacramento players. Although they have to play a little bit more above board than Beverage Association.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like the Medical Association, the Dental Association, is this just good governance for them? Is this just good policy for them, or is there?
No, it's their members.
They're believers.
Their members are true believers. Okay. It's like on vaccinations. I mean,
fair.
There's just a consensus.
No, so does mess up your teeth.
Yeah.
No,
so, I mean, there was just this belief. Okay. So the package announced today would be a tax that hasn't been specified, but some sort, maybe 2 cents an ounce, which was introduced last year, I believe, by Senator Bill Monning, labeling of sugar sweetened beverages. And I say that instead of soda, because this would include Gatorade, I think Gatorade now has a no sugar, 0 gram carbs drink, but they still have their sugar.
No, sweetened. Actual Gatorade is like
huge sugar.
Yeah, like 23 grams of sugar times two servings. That's awesome.
Yeah, they serve in these enormous bottles. Yeah. And so there's another point is, so you have the warnings, you have a possible tax. Then there's a bill that would cap the sale of a sugar sweetened beverage at 16 ounces.
If it's in an open lid or like the big gulp.
Right. Yeah. I don't think they're in. Yeah, it would be an open lid. But this would include restaurants, convenience stores, and movie theaters. Yeah. Well, I don't drink sugar sweetened beverages. These days I'm pretty much a water, coffee, tea person, but when I go to the movies, I like to get the big old large Diet Coke. That's like my treat for the week. And I was thinking about this bill, and I'm like, you know what? I bet the movie theaters won't even carry those big cups anymore if they can't sell the sugar sweetened beverages. If it's only the diet beverages, like 2 of the 8 on the fountain, why would they even bother stocking those cups? Now, for my friends that I go to the movies with, they're like, thank God, Scott, you already go to the bathroom plenty of times. I have a rule. Like, okay, if it's over 2 hours, 3 times in the bathroom is acceptable. But now I'm going to be running out to the damn concession stand 3 times because I'm going to keep needing to get my 12-ounce beverages.
Well, you know, what's funny is like Lorena Gonzalez put out this tweet, right? She says, like, I can't be the... she's so good at laying out her markers, I think, early in the session. Just being like, hey, this is where I'm at, Mm-hmm. But she kind of...
By the way, she's a very important legislator because she's the chair of the Assembly Appropriations Committee, right, which many people would consider the gatekeeper of all bills, because you can just kill bills on a fiscal standpoint and not on the policy.
Do these bills have fiscal tax?
All bills have fiscal impacts.
Okay, fair. So Lorena tweeted, it's like, I know I'm frugal, but I can't be the only one who gets a big gulp for the family to share because the movie theaters are so darn expensive, or something like that. Lorena, forgive me if I'm paraphrasing wrong, but she kind of like, also just going back to our previous point, there's an example, I think, of someone who handles their own Twitter and does it masterfully, why is she so good on Twitter? Because she engages with reporters, because she lets her true self of her personality shine, right? Like, she's like a dynamic and fun and witty person, and she allows that to be shown in her in her responses. Yeah. If you manage to get yourself elected to the state legislature, you're probably a pretty dynamic and witty and smart person, but you wouldn't know that looking through some of these Twitter feeds, But she's unafraid, man, and she's really... I think probably one of the most masterful uses of Twitter of any state legislator. But man, she put her marker out and she says, hey, I've got, like, early on, she says, I have a concern here, right? And I think it'll be interesting to see.
And that was, and that press conference had 5 legislators, 1 state senator, Bill Monning, and 4 assembly members, Bloom, Bonta, Chu, and Wicks, Chu of San Francisco. There are 2 Chus in the assembly. So having the chair of the Assembly Appropriations Committee setting out that marker against 4 members in her caucus was kind of a big move.
Yeah.
Now, it is a big caucus this year. But.
Yeah, it's a big... Yeah. So from a personal freedom perspective, man, I have no problem with taxing soda. People should be drinking less soda. I see my family... like I said, we're immigrants from Mexico, right? I lived in...
Where they actually have real Coke.
Where they have real Coke with the cane sugar. It's phenomenal. But
I've never seen it in a big gulp, though. It's glass bottles. Yeah, I mean, even they recycle those glass bottles.
Yeah, still. Yeah. But, you know, like, I feel like there's this other layer, actually, just for us personally. You know, we come from a country with no potable water. So if you're going to get, if you're at the store and you have to buy a drink, chances are you're not buying just water. Like, fuck it, I'm buying a drink. Sorry, yeah, I'm buying a drink anyways. Right. Might as well be a Coke. You know, and so I think, you know, those Latin American countries, like one of the big indicators, like when there's no potable water and you have to go buy a drink anyways, why not a Coke, you know? Mm-hmm. But from a personal freedom perspective, I hate to see my family, you know, eating, drinking Coke. I hate it. I hate it. But from a personal freedom perspective, this big gulp thing kind of bothers me just a little bit. You know, I feel like there's long haul truckers who take that big gulp and that's, you know, what they kind of feed themselves with, you know, for the day, you know, and why do you take that away from me? Like, why? You know, everything else I'm actually personally okay with. And, you know, maybe this isn't supposed to be so much of an opinion piece, but that's just, you know, I just feel like these rights are being stripped away from us. Like, why can't I buy a big
Well, and somebody driving, from Sacramento to Los Angeles while they're waiting for the train to be built, you know, would you rather them have a big form soda or a little Playmate cooler down in the well next to the passenger seat, and they're leaning over at 65 miles an hour to get out another one? I think there's going to be some good conversations this year, and that's the nice thing about February is you see these bills, and you just kind of look out and you say, oh, we're going to have some fun this year.
Hey, let me go back to this immigration thing with the wall thing, because one of the things that I wanted to riff on was this idea of like contrasts and narratives, right? And, you know, like I said, again, I'm no supporter of Trump's wall or of his emergency declaration, but, you know, I feel like the one interesting thing that's going on, and we can make an analogy here in the English parliament, the minority party drops their party label, and they're usually just referred to as the opposition party,
right?
And so I think what that means substantively is that whatever their platform was is out the window, and they're just in the business of opposing whatever the governing party is doing, right? And I think that's part of what's, you know, Trump is so hated and so reviled, you know, with good reason, that now the Democratic Party on a national level is just in the, and it's certainly in California, is now exclusively in the business of opposing everything that Trump does, right? And what I worry about is the contrast that we're setting up on a national level for a 2020 election with regards to immigration. There are legitimately non-racist places from which concerns over immigration can come from, okay? The strain on the health and human services safety net, undercutting the value of the labor pool, undercutting of labor organization efforts due to a mass class of folks who will do it for cheaper. I mean, I think Cesar Chavez was famously against undocumented workers. Mm-hmm. The perception, whether real or not, of influx of drugs and organized crime at the southern border. Again, whether real or not, just the perception of it is a thing, okay? And the remnants of untaxed of wages earned in America to other countries. Again, all I'm saying is that there can be a legitimate, non-racist place where concerns over immigration can come from. These were Democratic talking points just 10 years ago. Right. You can pull up videos of Obama, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton talking about these issues, right? Mm-hmm. And now we're so opposed to Trump that we're just taking the opposite stance of whatever he's doing that I worry that we're going to set up a favorable contrast for him in 2020.
Well, I think I think that the Democrats are just exasperated that they can't have a discussion. I mean, he dangled the issue of the deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA.
No.
He kept saying, oh, we're going to do a fix. We're going to do a fix for DACA and for the TPS, the temporary protected status folks from certain countries that would face persecution if they return. And then he pulled back from that after really kind of promising that he was going to take care of it. And then in the last 2 months, he offered a 3-year moratorium on action for deferred action childhood arrivals, which is like, okay, you know, it's like your landlord saying, okay, you've got another 30 days, that you can stay, but then you've got to get out. Mm-hmm. And I think Democrats are just exasperated because, you know, DACA and the DREAM Act itself, which goes further than DACA, much further, was co-authored by many Senate Republicans, including Senator McCain, Senator Lindsey Graham. And it's now being completely used for political purposes on both sides, as you accurately point out. But I just think that the Democrats feel that they have no way to deal with President Trump at this point.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't had a good answer for him in a while.
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, and he doesn't help by, today it was, crazy Bernie. I mean, what do we get out of, you've got, a United States senator that's running for president, and like, as during his opening, his coming out, rollout of his presidential nomination, before he's proposed anything, it's crazy Bernie. I'm not a huge Bernie Sanders fan, but I mean, the person that wins on this is Larry David, if he gets to come back and play him again on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
But, that kind of name calling, it just, it leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And that would be the same case if it was a Democratic president.
Yeah.
It's not partisan, but that just poisons the well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I think he's doing with those names?
What?
I think he's going back to the old pro wrestling days. I think, Trump was written into the script of the WWF for quite some time. And I think at some point he was either an investor or had some sort of ownership stake in the WWF. And aside from the wrestlers, you know what the number one classification of employees is? It's writers.
Yeah.
They employ a bunch of writers. Yeah. Part of this is like, I just listen to a lot of podcasts of like professional wrestling. I don't watch professional wrestling, but what they talk about from a storytelling perspective is really interesting. When 2016 happened and when 2020 happens, he will have more combined TV hours than the rest of the field combined. He'll have more TV hours than everyone else combined because he spent all that time on WWF, because he spent all that time on The Apprentice. Just as an example, and I'll get back to the name thing in 1 second. He did this thing with Rubio at one of the debates that was freaking masterful. Okay. He understood that the camera was on him. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he said something derogatory about Rubio, but he knew that it was his 60 seconds on the camera. So when he said something derogatory about Rubio, Rubio was from off camera trying to address him back, naturally a position of weakness. Because the people are watching Rubio from off camera. Hey, you don't say that about me.
Right.
But Trump is talking to you with his hands like this and he appears all powerful, right? Mm-hmm. Trump understood that dynamic. Rubio did not, right? Mm-hmm. And so he understands when the camera's on him. He understands when you appear weak because you're not on camera. He understands when he says something and he triggers you and you're like off camera and trying to get in the shot, right? And I think that's part of what he's doing with this name calling, okay? He usually combines some sort of like pejorative with like their physical appearance or their sort of emotional state. Mm-hmm. So it's like a physical thing and an emotional state, and they come together. And I think one of the worst things that can happen in sort of just personal narratives and reputation is when something that was thought about you that was negative is confirmed to be true, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I knew that Gibran was always a scumbag, and now I heard something that he is a scumbag as I heard it. I thought it was true and now it's been confirmed to be true, right? And so I think, like Bernie with his disheveled hair and he's always kind of hectoring you, he's not crazy, but like he's like Trump is kind of, he's like dancing on that line of like, you could see Bernie going kind of Howard Dean because he's so passionate, and so, but if he does, Trump has already set that trap on the other end of on the other side of the line,
right.
So I think what he's trying to do is just box people into their personality traits and set up like a narrative trap where I say something that might be confirmed to be true, right? With like Crooked Hillary, or like the Pocahontas thing with Senator Warren is damning because he said it and then it was confirmed to be true, right? Like, again, no judgments here, but it was damning to the people that are already inclined to, to damn her. So I think that's what he's doing with these sort of like, these sort of names and stuff. I don't condone it, but I think his use of it is pretty masterful, just in terms of like, because there's no good way to respond to that from a proper political perspective. What are you going to do? Get in the mud and start name calling with him too? You don't want to do that. Like, he's so hard to deal with. Like, like who, what would you even say? I can't even imagine having an argument with that guy. He would just yell at me until I got broke, broke down, Like, how do you have an argument with a crazy person? I don't know. Long rant.
Nancy has, I think, a pretty good ability to control. But, I think we're nearing the end of our time. But It kind of comes back to where we started with Kamala Harris. He hasn't given her a name. He's given her very little attention.
I think she matches up well against him.
He went after Klobuchar for the Frosty the Snowman a campaign announcement. Now, Klobuchar, I think, more than made up for that kind of silly day by her town hall meeting on CNN on Monday night. She did very well, I thought. But it's been very interesting that that Trump has not engaged with Kamala Harris. Conventional wisdom would be that he's not engaging because he sees her as not a threat. But we know that she is one of three that they have a conscious opposition research effort against right now.
Yeah.
They're taking her very seriously.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think she, and as a former prosecutor too, right? I mean, I think she brings the, she's not to be messed with, you know?
Right.
I think she matches up exceptionally well against him, actually.
Yeah.
Before we go, right about 55 minutes, you're right. A couple other miscellaneous items here. Not miscellaneous to the people they affect, but still important. Public safety. 11-2020 ballot measure, CCPOA contract negotiations. Can you touch on those for us?
Well, yeah. So Proposition 47 was passed in 2010, I want to say. No, 2012, I think.
12.
And it made some drug-oriented crimes. It reduced them from felony to misdemeanors, nonviolent crimes, and also allowed for earlier parole for nonviolent offenders. Some argue that it's increased crime rates in California. There's not much evidence of that. But what there is evidence of, actually there's confirmation of, is there's a ballot measure that's already qualified for November 2020 to repeal many of those criminal justice softening, if you will, reforms that were championed by former Governor Jerry Brown. Now, we have a ballot measure that's already qualified for November 2020, but the biggest funder of that ballot measure is the California Correctional Peace Officers Association. Huh. They gave that committee $2 million in December. Now they're asking for their $2 million back. If they get that money back, the campaign is basically broke. And they're only, unless some hero comes out, a multimillionaire or billionaire comes out of the woodwork and says, I want to champion this, the campaign is dead without CCPOA. They simply can't get enough money from the Los Angeles Police Protective League and other unions. And the interesting thing about CCPOA asking for their $2 million back is their contract is up for negotiation. It expires in June. Gavin Newsom's administration is thus negotiating this new contract. As Gavin Newsom cited in his budget presentation back in January, each 1% compensation increase for the prison guards is about, it's in the high 40 million, it's near $50 million for each 1%. So it's a big, and it's ongoing. It's not like you just throw in, a bonus to people. These would be built into the salaries. Many people see that CCPOA pulling back asking for its $2 million back. I don't think they've gotten it back yet. Many people see that as an olive branch to Governor Newsom for contract negotiations. Now, it also fits in from the Governor Newsom's standpoint that Governor Newsom did a couple things in January that didn't make Jerry Brown very happy. He cut back on high-speed rail, and he changed the water tunnels. We didn't really get into those today. We'll have plenty of time to talk about that. He's proposing one tunnel instead of two. It's not a new idea. It was around last year. Many people thought that's where we'd be going. But I think Gavin would like to give Jerry something in exchange for losing or for cutting back on Governor Brown's dreams for those two big projects. And if he can help prevail on
the public
getting that ballot
stuff,
measure pulled off from November 2020, because now under the law, under a Daryl Steinberg law, you can pull out ballot measures after something called good faith negotiation and furtherance of the ballot measure. Nobody knows what the heck that means, but proponents.
That means the parties can get together in the smoky room and figure it out.
Yeah. So be watching that, because that's going to be very interesting. Yeah. Obviously, the criminal justice side with the bail referendum on the November 2020 ballot, and with this possible public safety measure on the November 2020 ballot, and possibly with Kamala Harris on the November 2020 ballot, either in the presidential spot or vice presidential spot. Most people want to settle some of those issues and clear that ballot up, and that those CCPOA contract negotiations could be key to that.
Gotcha. Hey, last thing for you before we wrap up here. We're recording this Wednesday night. There's a good chance when this hits on Thursday that Oakland Unified is on strike.
That's right.
Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah.
I know some of these staffers are listening. They're just like drinking from the fire hose. So it's like kind of help put this into context.
Yeah. For folks. So Oakland Unified School District, they've been in negotiations for a while. As we know, in January, Los Angeles Unified had a strike that lasted for a couple of weeks over compensation issues. But the big issue in LA Unified was about establishing a cap on charter schools.
Yeah.
Yesterday, a bill passed unanimously in Senate Education Committee that would increase transparency and accountability for charter schools. For the political policy geeks out there, it would put charter schools under the Brown Act, the Public Records Act, and the state's Conflict of Interest Code.
So it probably should have been the whole time.
Well,
honestly,
it's legally debatable as to whether or not they are. And so this would make it explicit. Yeah.
Why wouldn't they be, though? I mean, they're publicly funded.
They are, but they're not public agencies.
Gotcha.
So if you're running a local nonprofit and you get a grant,
are you not subject
you're
to
not
the Brown
subject
Act?
To them. And that's the theory as to why they aren't.
Yeah, let's just clarify that and put them in. Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
But the big issue is the moratorium. That was for LA Unified. The LA Unified Board has approved a resolution calling on Sacramento to establish a moratorium. That's going to be a big issue of debate this year. It appears that Oakland Unified is really about compensation. And the parties, the last I looked, they were... the Oakland Education Association, the teachers union, was asking for 12%. And as of yesterday, I think the proposal from Oakland Unified worked out to 8.5%, with 1.5% of that being a one-time allocation. That's big, because if you're familiar with education compensation, they operate on a step and column basis. So steps are how many years you've been in service of the district, and then columns are based on your educational achievement. So you go from 4 to 5 years, you get a salary bump. You go from a bachelor's degree to a master's degree, you get a salary bump. Those changes take effect on July 1 of each year. So Oakland Unified has proposed a one-time bonus, which wouldn't affect those salary schedules for 2017-2018, and then a 3% increase effective January 1st of 2019, a 2% increase effective January 1st, 2020, and a 1% increase effective January 1st, 2021, and another 1% for June 30th of 2021. Mm. Note June 30th. Why June 30th? Well, because it's those salary schedules. Yeah. So it is as much about the timing of the percentage increases as it is the percentages themselves, because of the compounding nature, and obviously the state's cost of living adjustments in each year's budget affects all of that as well. So it's going to be interesting to play out. I think that regardless of how negotiations are going on, they were going on as of late this afternoon, I think that the Oakland teachers want to have a strike. They saw LA go out and have a strike, and you build up momentum to have a strike, and you get people emotionally prepared, you get people moving their money. It's kind of like the federal shutdown. You know, people at a certain point, they get all prepared, they're ready to do it. Right. And you know, as a union leader, it's kind of hard to come out and say, we've got a compromise, you know, at 11:59 p.m. the night before your strike starts. So I fully expect that by the time our listeners hear this, the teachers will be out on strike, but I expect it'll be done within, 10 days.
Okay. Very cool. That's a pretty good show. What a week. Another couple things that happened, Modesto rolled out little tents under the freeway. We should maybe talk about this more when we have some other guests on that are more able to speak in depth.
We have a lot to talk about homeless, K Street, mental health, addiction. Yeah. We've been talking about this a lot offline.
Yeah. Next time we talk, let's talk about Space Force. Okay. I think Trump's right about space. You know who actually one of the big proponents of Space Force was Neil deGrasse Tyson. Because it'll spur, you know, investment in space exploration and whatnot. But
I just want my Alexa to work.
Yeah.
You know, that's my Space Force, is like making sure my to-do list is I can orally request that she remind me to take out my trash, which was my first experience.
But before we wrap, for folks listening, on a serious note, if you want more likely than not Scott's analysis, not my analysis, but if you want Scott's analysis on some of this stuff, tweet us at Jabron Maciel, at Scott Lay, and just let us know what topics you would like us to cover. Scott brings a level of analysis that is, I think, unmatched in Sacramento. And just let us know what you want us to cover, and we can go over that stuff for you.
And thanks again to Probolsky Research at ProbolskyResearch.com for sponsoring tonight's episode, or this week, tonight, whenever you listen to it, while you're riding on the American River Bike Trail, or I don't know if you're going to go up skiing. There's all this great snow, news on the waterfront for California. So we've got some good things going on.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Take care.